urged at one point, and it is that borderline I would like to fix, and I feel I fail to do so utterly. Why? The stipulation of the Roman law, according to which a girl may marry at 12, was adopted by the Church and is still preserved rather tacitly in some of the United States. And 15 is lawful everywhere. There is nothing wrong, say both hemispheres, when a brute of 40, blessed by the local priest and bloated with drink, sheds his sweat-drenched finery and thrusts himself up to the hilt into his youthful bride. In such stimulating temperate climates, says an old magazine in this prison library, as St. Louis, Chicago, and Cincinnati, girls mature about the end of their 12th year. Dolores Hayes was born less than 300 miles from stimulating Cincinnati. I have but followed nature. I am nature's faithful hound. Why then this horror that I cannot shake off? Did I deprive her of her flower? Sensitive gentlewomen of the jury, I was not even her first lover. She told me the way she had been debauched. We ate flavourless mealy bananas, bruised peaches and very palatable potato chips, and Decliner told me everything. Her voluble but disjointed account was accompanied by many a droll moue, as I think I have already observed. I especially remembered one wry face on an ugh basis, jelly mouth distended sideways and eyes rolled up in a routine blend of comic disgust, resignation and tolerance for young frailty. Her astounding tale started with an introductory mention of her tentmate of the previous summer at another camp, a very select one, as she put it. That tentmate, quite a derelict character, half crazy but a swell kid, instructed her in various manipulations. At first, Loyal Low refused to tell me her name. Was it Grace Angel? I asked. She shook her head. No, it wasn't. It was the daughter of a big shot. Was it perhaps Rose Carmine? No, of course not. Her father. Was it then Agnes Sheridan, perchance? She swallowed and shook her head, and then did a double take. Say, how come you know all those kids? I explained. Well, she said, they are pretty bad, some of that school bunch, but not that bad. If you have to know, her name was Elizabeth Talbot. She goes now to a swanky private school. Her father is an executive. I recalled with a funny pang the frequency with which poor Charlotte used to introduce into party chat such elegant tidbits as, "When my daughter was out hiking last year with the Talbot girl," I wanted to know if either mother had learned of those sapphic diversions. "Gosh, no!" exhaled Limp Low, mimicking dread and relief, pressing a falsely fluttering hand to her chest. I was more interested, however, in heterosexual experience. She had entered the 6th grade at 11, soon after moving to Ramsdale from the Middle West. What did she mean by pretty bad? Well, the Miranda twins had shared the same bed for years, and Donald Scott, who was the dumbest boy in the school, had done it with Hazel Smith in his uncle's garage, and Kenneth Knight, who was the brightest, used to examine himself wherever and whenever he had the chance. And let us switch to Camp Q, I said. And presently I got the whole story. Barbara Burke, a sturdy blonde, 2 years older than Low, and by far the camp's best swimmer, had a very special canoe, which she shared with Low, because I was the only other girl who could make Willow Island, some swimming test, I imagine. Through July, every morning, mark, reader, every blessed morning, Barbara and Lo would be helped to carry the boat to Onyx or Eryx, two small lakes in the wood, by Charlie Holmes, the camp mistress's son, aged 13, and the only human male for a couple of miles around, excepting an old, meek, stone-deaf handyman and a farmer in an old Ford who sometimes sold the campers eggs, as farmers will. Every morning, oh my reader, the three children would take a shortcut through the beautiful innocent forest, brimming with all the emblems of youth, dew, bird songs, and at one point, among the luxuriant undergrowth, Lo would be left a sentinel while Barbara and the boy copulated behind a bush. At first, Lo had refused to try what it was like, but curiosity and camaraderie prevailed, and soon she and Barbara were doing it by turns with the silent, coarse and surly but indefatigable Charlie, who had as much sex appeal as a raw carrot, but sported a fascinating collection of contraceptives, which he used to fish out of the third nearby lake, a considerably larger and more populous one called Lake Climax, after the booming young factory town of that name. Although conceding it was sort of fun, and fine for the complexion, Lolita, I am glad to say, held Charlie's mind and manners in the greatest contempt. Nor had her temperament been roused by that filthy fiend. In fact, I think he had rather stunned it, despite the fun. By that time, it was close to 10. With the ebb of lust, an ashen sense of awfulness, abetted by the realistic drabness of a grey neuralgic day, crept over me and hummed within my temples. Brown, naked, frail, low, her narrow white buttocks to me, her sulky face to a door mirror, stood, arms akimbo, feet in new slippers with pussy fur tops wide apart, and through a forehanging lock tritely mugged at herself in the glass. From the corridor came the cooing voices of coloured maids at work, and presently there was a mild attempt to open the door of our room. I had Lo go to the bathroom and take a much-needed soap shower. The bed was a frightful mess with overtones of potato chips. She tried on a two-piece navy wool, then a sleeveless blouse with a swirly clathrate skirt. But the first was too tight and the second too ample, and when I begged her to hurry up, the situation was beginning to frighten me, Lo viciously sent those nice presents of mine hurtling into a corner and put on yesterday's dress. When she was ready at last, I gave her a lovely new purse of simulated calf, in which I had slipped quite a few pennies and 2 mint-bright dimes, and told her to buy herself a magazine in the lobby. "I'll be down in a minute," I said. "And if I were you, my dear, I wouldn't talk to strangers." Except for my poor little gifts, there was not much to pack. But I was forced to devote a dangerous amount of time, was she up to something downstairs, to arranging the bed in such a way as to suggest the abandonedness of a restless father and his tomboy daughter, instead of an ex-convict saturnalia with a couple of fat old whores. Then I finished dressing and had the hoary bellboy come up for the bags. Everything was fine. There in the lobby she sat, deep in an overstuffed blood-red armchair, deep in a lurid movie magazine. A fellow of my age in tweeds, the genre of the place had changed overnight to a spurious country squire atmosphere, was staring at my Lolita over his dead cigar and stale newspaper. She wore her professional white socks and saddle oxfords, and that bright print frock with the square throat. A splash of jaded lamplight brought out the golden down on her warm brown limbs. There she sat, her legs carelessly high-crossed, and her pale eyes skimming along the lines with every now and then a blink. Bill's wife had worshipped him from afar long before they ever met. In fact, she used to secretly admire the famous young actor as he ate Sundays in Schwab's drugstore. Nothing could have been more childish than her snub nose, freckled face, or the purplish spot on her naked neck where a fairy-tale vampire had feasted, or the unconscious movement of her tongue exploring a touch of rosy rash around her swollen lips. Nothing could be more harmless than to read about Jill, an energetic starlet who made her own clothes and was a student of serious literature. Nothing could be more innocent than the part of that glossy brown hair with that silky sheen on the temple. Nothing could be more naive. But what sickening envy the lecherous fellow, whoever he was. Come to think of it, he resembled a little my Swiss Uncle Gustav, also a great admirer of Le Découvert. Would have experienced had he known that every nerve in me was still anointed and ringed with the feel of her body, the body of some immortal daemon disguised as a female child. Was Pink Pig Mr. Swoon absolutely sure my wife had not telephoned? He was. If she did, would he tell her we had gone to Aunt Claire's place? He would indeedy. I settled the bill and roused Lo from her chair. She read to the car. Still reading, she was driven to a so-called coffee shop a few blocks south. Oh, she ate all right. She even laid aside her magazine to eat. But a queer dullness had replaced her usual cheerfulness. I knew little Lo could be very nasty, so I braced myself and grinned, and waited for a squall. I was unbathed, unshaven, and had had no bowel movement. My nerves were a jangle. I did not like the way my little mistress shrugged her shoulders and distended her nostrils when I attempted casual small talk. Had Phyllis been in the know before she joined her parents in Maine? I asked with a smile. Look, said Lowe, making a weeping grimace. Let us get off the subject. I then tried, also unsuccessfully, no matter how I smacked my lips, to interest her in the road map. Our destination was, let me remind my patient reader, whose meek temper Lowe ought to have copied, the gay town of Leppingville, somewhere near a hypothetical hospital. The destination was in itself a perfectly arbitrary one, as alas so many were to be, and I shook in my shoes as I wondered how to keep the whole arrangement plausible, and what other plausible objectives to invent after we had taken in all the movies in Leppingville. More and more uncomfortable did Humbert feel. It was something quite special, that feeling. An oppressive, hideous constraint, as if I was sitting with the small ghost of somebody I had just killed. As she was in the act of getting back into the car, an expression of pain flitted across Lowe's face. It flitted again, more meaningfully, as she settled down beside me. No doubt she reproduced it that second time for my benefit. Foolishly, I asked her what was the matter. "Nothing, you brute," she replied. "You what?" I asked. She was silent. Leaving Bryceland, loquacious Lowe was silent. Cold spiders of panic crawled down my back. This was an orphan. This was a lone child, an absolute waif with whom a heavy-limbed, foul-smelling adult had had strenuous intercourse three times that very morning. Whether or not the realization of a lifelong dream had surpassed all expectation, it had, in a sense, overshot its mark and plunged into a nightmare. I had been careless, stupid, and ignoble. And let me be quite frank, somewhere at the bottom of that dark turmoil I felt the writhing of desire again, so monstrous was my appetite for that miserable nymphette. Mingled with the pangs of guilt was the agonizing thought that her mood might prevent me from making love to her again as soon as I found a nice country road where to park in peace. In other words, poor Humbert Humbert was dreadfully unhappy. And while steadily and inanely driving toward Leppingville, he kept racking his brains for some quip under the bright wing of which he might dare turn to his seatmate. It was she, however, who broke the silence. "Oh, squash squirrel," she said. "What a shame." "Yes, isn't it?" Eager, hopeful hum. "Let us stop at the next gas station," Lowe continued. "I want to go to the washroom." "We shall stop wherever you want," I said. And then, as a lovely, lonely, supercilious grove, oaks, I thought, American trees at that stage were beyond me, started to echo greenly the rush of our car. A red and ferny road on our right turned its head before slanting into the woodland, and I suggested we might perhaps— "Drive on!" my Lowe cried shrilly. "Righto, take it easy. Down, poor beast, down." I glanced at her. Thank God the child was smiling. "You chump," she said, sweetly smiling at me. "You revolting creature. I was a daisy fresh girl, and look what you've done to me. I ought to call the police and tell them you raped me. Oh, you dirty, dirty old man." Was she just joking? An ominous hysterical note rang through her silly words. Presently, making a sizzling sound with her lips, she started complaining of pains, said she could not sit, said I'd torn something inside her. A sweat rolled down my neck, and we almost ran over some little animal or other that was crossing the road with tail erect, and again my vile-tempered companion called me an ugly name. When we stopped at the filling station, she scrambled out without a word, and was a long time away. Slowly, lovingly, an elderly friend with a broken nose wiped my windshield. "They do it differently at every place, from chamois cloth to soapy brush. This fellow used a pink sponge." She appeared at last. "Look," she said in that neutral voice that hurt me so, "give me some dimes and nickels. I want to call Mother in that hospital. What's the number?" "Get in," I said. "You can't call that number." "Why?" "Get in and slam the door." She got in and slammed the door. The old garage man beamed at her. I swung onto the highway. "Why can't I call my mother if I want to?" "Because," I answered, "your mother is dead." In the gay town of Leppingville, I bought her four books of comics, a box of candy, a box of sanitary pads, two cokes, a manicure set, a travel clock with a luminous dial, a ring with a real topaz, a tennis racket, roller skates with white high shoes, field glasses, a portable radio set, chewing gum, a transparent raincoat, sunglasses, some more garments, swooners, shorts, all kinds of summer frocks. At the hotel we had separate rooms, but in the middle of the night she came sobbing into mine, and we made it up very gently. You see, she had absolutely nowhere else to go. It was then that began our extensive travels all over the States. To any other type of tourist accommodation, I soon grew to prefer the functional motel. Clean, neat, safe nooks, ideal places for sleep, argument, reconciliation, insatiable, illicit love. At first, in my dread of arousing suspicion, I would eagerly pay for both sections of one double unit, each containing a double bed. I wondered what type of foursome this arrangement was ever intended for, since only a pharisaic parity of privacy could be attained by means of the incomplete partition dividing the cabin or room into two communicating love nests. By and by, the very possibilities that such honest promiscuity suggested, two young couples merrily swapping mates, or a child shamming sleep to ear-witness primal sonorities, made me bolder, and every now and then I would take a bed and cot, or twin-bed cabin, a prison cell of paradise, with yellow window shades pulled down to create a morning illusion of Venice and sunshine, when actually it was Pennsylvania and rain. We came to know, nous connûmes, to use a Flaubertian intonation, the stone cottages under enormous Chateaubriand-esque trees, the brick unit, the adobe unit, the stucco court, on what the tour book of the Automobile Association describes as shaded or spacious or landscaped grounds. The log kind, finished in knotty pine, reminded Lowe, by its golden-brown glaze, of fried chicken bones. We held in contempt the plain whitewashed clapboard cabins with their faint sewerish smell or some other gloomy self-conscious stench, and nothing to boast of except good beds and an unsmiling landlady always prepared to have her gift, well, I could give you, turned down. Nous connûmes, this is royal fun, the would-be enticements of their repetitious names, all those sunset motels, U-beam cottages, Hillcrest courts, Pine View courts, Mountain View courts, Skyline courts, Park Plaza courts, Green Acres, Max courts. There was sometimes a special line in the write-up, such as, children welcome, pets allowed, you are welcome, you are allowed. The baths were mostly tiled showers, with an endless variety of spouting mechanisms, but with one definitely non-Laodicean characteristic in common, a propensity, while in use, to turn instantly beastly hot or blindingly cold upon you, depending on whether your neighbour turned on his cold or his hot to deprive you of a necessary compliment in the shower you had so carefully blended. Some motels had instructions pasted above the toilet, on whose tank the towels were unhygienically heaped, asking guests not to throw into its bowl garbage, beer cans, cartons, stillborn babies. Others had special notices under glass, such as things to do. Riding. You will often see riders coming down the main street on their way back from a romantic moonlight ride. Yeah, often at 3 a.m, sneered unromantic Low. Nous connûmes, the various types of motor court operators, the reformed criminal, the retired teacher and the business flop among the males, and the motherly, pseudo-ladylike and madamic variants among the females. And sometimes trains would cry in the monstrously hot and humid night with heart-rending and ominous plangency, mingling power and hysteria in one desperate scream. We avoided tourist homes, country cousins of funeral ones, old-fashioned, genteel and showerless with elaborate dressing tables in depressingly white and pink little bedrooms, and photographs of the landlady's children in all their instars. But I did surrender now and then to Lowe's predilection for real hotels. She would pick out in the book while I petted her in the parked car in the silence of a dusk-mellowed, mysterious side road, some highly recommended lake lodge which offered all sorts of things magnified by the flashlight she moved over them, such as congenial company, between meals snacks, outdoor barbecues, but which in my mind conjured up odious visions of stinking high school boys in sweatshirts and an ember-red cheek pressing against hers while poor Dr. Humbert, embracing nothing but two masculine knees, would cold-humour his piles on the damp turf. Most tempting to her, too, were these colonial inns, which apart from gracious atmosphere and picture windows promised unlimited quantities of food. Treasured recollections of my father's palatial hotel sometimes led me to seek for its like in the strange country we travelled through. I was soon discouraged. But Lowe kept following the scent of rich food ads, while I derived a not exclusively economic kick from such roadside signs as Timber Hotel, Children Under 14 Free. On the other hand, I shudder when recalling that soi-disant high-class resort in a Midwestern state which advertised, "Raid the icebox, midnight stacks," and, intrigued by my accent, wanted to know my dead wife's and my dead mother's maiden names. A 2 days' stay there cost me $124. And do you remember, Miranda, the other ultra-smart robber's den with complimentary morning coffee and circulating ice water and no children under 16? No Lolitas, of course? Immediately upon arrival at one of the plainer motor courts which became our habitual haunts, she would set the electric fan awhir or induce me to drop a quarter into the radio, and she would read all the signs and inquire with a whine why she could not go riding up some advertised trail or swimming in that local pool of warm mineral water. Most often, in the slouching, bored way she cultivated, Lo would fall prostrate and abominably desirable into the red spring chair or a green chaise longue, or a steamer chair of striped canvas with footrest and canopy, or a sling chair, or any other lawn chair under the garden umbrella on the patio, and it would take hours of blandishments, threats, and promises to make her lend me for a few seconds her brown limbs in the seclusion of the $5 room before undertaking anything she might prefer to my poor joy. A combination of naivete and deception, of charm and vulgarity, of blue sulks and rosy mirth, Lolita, when she chose, could be a most exasperating brat. I was not really quite prepared for her fits of disorganized boredom, intense and vehement griping, her sprawling, droopy, dopey-eyed style, and what is called goofing off, a kind of diffused clowning which she thought was tough in a boyish hoodlum way. Mentally, I found her to be a disgustingly conventional little girl. Sweet hot jazz, square dancing, gooey fudge sundaes, musicals, movie magazines and so forth, these were the obvious items in her list of beloved things. The Lord knows how many nickels I fed to the gorgeous music boxes that came with every meal we had. I still hear the nasal voices of those invisibles serenading her, people with names like Sammy and Joe, Eddie and Tony, and Peggy and Guy, and Patty and Rex, and sentimental song hits, all of them as similar to my ear as her various candies were to my palate. She believed with a kind of celestial trust any advertisement or advice that appeared in Movie Love or Screenland. Staracil starves pimples, or you better watch out if you're wearing your shirt tails outside your jeans, girls, because Jill says you shouldn't. If a roadside sign said, visit our gift shop, we had to visit it, had to buy its Indian curios, dolls, copper jewellery, cactus candy. The words novelties and souvenirs simply entranced her by their trochaic lilt. If some cafe sign proclaimed ice-cold drinks, she was automatically stirred, although all drinks everywhere were ice-cold. She it was to whom ads were dedicated, the ideal consumer, the subject and object of every foul poster, and she attempted, unsuccessfully, to patronise only those restaurants where the holy spirit of Hunkin' Dines had descended upon the cute paper napkins and cottage cheese-crested salads. In those days, neither she nor I had thought up yet the system of monetary bribes which was to work such havoc with my nerves and her morals somewhat later. I relied on three other methods to keep my pubescent concubine in submission and passable temper. A few years before, she had spent a rainy summer under Miss Phelan's bleary eye in a dilapidated Appalachian farmhouse that had belonged to some gnarled Hayes or other in the dead past. It still stood among its rank acres of goldenrod on the edge of a flowerless forest, at the end of a permanently muddy road, 20 miles from the nearest hamlet. Lo recalled that scarecrow of a house, the solitude, the soggy old pastures, the wind, the bloated wilderness, with an energy of disgust that distorted her mouth and fattened her half-revealed tongue. And it was there that I warned her she would dwell with me in exile for months and years, if need be, studying under me French and Latin, unless her present attitude changed. Charlotte, I began to understand you. A simple child, Lo would scream no and frantically clutch at my driving hand whenever I put a stop to her tornadoes of temper by turning in the middle of a highway with the implication that I was about to take her straight to that dark and dismal abode. The farther, however, we travelled away from it west, the less tangible that menace became, and I had to adopt other methods of persuasion. Among these, the reformatory threat is the one I recall with the deepest moan of shame. From the very beginning of our concourse, I was clever enough to realize that I must secure her complete cooperation in keeping our relations secret. that it should become a second nature to her, no matter what grudge she might bear me, no matter what other pleasures she might seek. "Come and kiss your old man," I would say, "and drop that moody nonsense. In former times, when I was still your dream male," the reader will notice what pains I took to speak Lowe's language, "you swooned to records of the number one throb-and-sob idol of your coevals." Lowe: "And my what? Speak English. That idol of your pals sounded, you thought, like friend Humbert. But now I am just your old man, a dream dad protecting his dream daughter. My chère Dolores, I want to protect you, dear, from all the horrors that happen to little girls in coal sheds and alleyways, and alas, comme vous le savez trop bien, mon gentil, in the blueberry woods during the bluest of summers. Through thick and thin I will stay your guardian, and if you are good, I hope a court may legalize that guardianship before long. Let us, however, forget Dolores Hayes, so-called legal terminology, terminology that accepts as rational the term lewd and lascivious cohabitation. I am not a criminal sexual psychopath taking indecent liberties with a child. The rapist was Charlie Holmes. I am the therapist, a matter of nice spacing in the way of distinction. I am your dadum, though. Look, I've a learned book here about young girls. Now look, darling, what it says, I quote, "The normal girl," normal, mark you, "the normal girl is usually extremely anxious to please her father. She feels in him the forerunner of the desired elusive male." Elusive is good, by Bolognese. "The wise mother," and your poor mother would have been wise had she lived, "will encourage a companionship between father and daughter, realizing, excuse the corny style, that the girl forms her ideals of romance and of men from her association with her father." Now, what association does this cheery book mean and recommend? I quote again. "Among Sicilians, sexual relations between a father and his daughter are accepted as a matter of course, and the girl who participates in such a relationship is not looked upon with disapproval by the society of which she is a part. I'm a great admirer of Sicilians, fine athletes, fine musicians, fine, upright people, though, and great lovers. But let's not digress. Only the other day we read in the newspaper some bunkum about a middle-aged morals offender who pleaded guilty to the violation of the Mann Act and to transporting a 9-year-old girl across state lines for immoral purposes, whatever these are. Dolores, darling, you are not 9, but almost 13. And I would not advise you to consider yourself my cross-country slave, and I deplore the Mann Act as lending itself to a dreadful pun, the revenge that the gods of semantics take against tight-zippered Philistines. I am your father, and I am speaking English, and I love you. Finally, let us see what happens if you, a minor, accused of having impaired the morals of an adult in a respectable inn, what happens if you complain to the police of my having kidnapped and raped you? Let us suppose they believe you. A minor female, who allows a person over 21 to know her carnally, involves her victim into statutory rape, or second-degree sodomy, depending on the technique, and the maximum penalty is 10 years. So, I go to jail. Okay, I go to jail, but what happens to you, my orphan? Well, you are luckier. You become the ward of the Department of Public Welfare, which I'm afraid sounds a little bleak. A nice grim matron of the Miss Phelan type, but more rigid and not a drinking woman, will take away your lipstick and fancy clothes. No more gadding about. I don't know if you've ever heard of the laws relating to dependent, neglected, incorrigible, delinquent children, but while I stand gripping the bars, you, happy neglected child, will be given a choice of various dwelling places, all more or less the same, the correctional school, the reformatory, the juvenile detention home, or one of those admirable girls' protectories where you knit things and sing hymns and have rancid pancakes on Sundays. You will go there, Lolita. My Lolita. This Lolita will leave her catullus and go there, as the wayward girl you are. In plainer words, if we two are found out, you will be analysed and institutionalised, my pet. C'est tout. You will dwell, my Lolita will dwell, come here, my brown flower, with 39 other dopes in a dirty dormitory. No, allow me, please. Under the supervision of hideous matrons. This is the situation. This is the choice. Don't you think that under the circumstances, Dolores Hayes had better stick to her old man? By rubbing all this in, I succeeded in terrorizing Lowe, who, despite a certain brash alertness of manner and spurts of wit, was not as intelligent a child as her IQ might suggest. But if I managed to establish that background of shared secrecy and shared guilt, I was much less successful in keeping her in good humor. Every morning during our year-long travels, I had to devise some expectation, some special point in space and time for her to look forward to, for her to survive till bedtime. Otherwise, deprived of a shaping and sustaining purpose, the skeleton of her day sagged and collapsed. The object in view might be anything, a lighthouse in Virginia, a natural cave in Arkansas converted to a cafe, a collection of guns and violins somewhere in Oklahoma, a replica of the Grotto of Lourdes in Louisiana, shabby photographs of the Bonanza mining period in the local museum of a Rocky Mountains resort, anything whatsoever, but it had to be there in front of us like a fixed star, although as likely as not, Lo would feign gagging as soon as we got to it. By putting the geography of the United States into motion, I did my best for hours on end to give her the impression of going places, of rolling on to some definite destination, to some unusual delight. I have never seen such smooth, amiable roads as those that now radiated before us, across the crazy quilt of 48 states. Voraciously we consumed these long highways. In rapt silence we glided over their glossy black dance floors. Not only had Lo no eye for scenery, but she furiously resented my calling her attention to this or that enchanting detail of landscape, which I myself learned to discern only after being exposed for quite a time to the delicate beauty ever present in the margin of our undeserving journey. By a paradox of pictorial thought, the average lowland North American countryside had at first seemed to me something I accepted with a shock of amused recognition because of those painted oilcloths which were imported from America in the old days to be hung above washstands in central European nurseries, and which fascinated a drowsy child at bedtime with the rustic green views they depicted. Opaque curly trees, a barn, cattle, a brook, the dull white of vague orchards in bloom, and perhaps a stone fence or hills of greenish gouache. But gradually the models of those elementary rusticities became stranger and stranger to the eye the nearer I came to know them. Beyond the tilled plain, beyond the toy roofs, there would be a slow suffusion of inutile loveliness, a low sun in a platinum haze with a warm peeled peach tinge pervading the upper edge of a two-dimensional dove-grey cloud fusing with the distant amorous mist. There might be a line of spaced trees silhouetted against the horizon, and hot still noons above a wilderness of clover, and clawed rain clouds inscribed remotely into misty azure, with only their cumulus part conspicuous against the neutral swoon of the background. Or again, it might be a stern El Greco horizon, pregnant with inky rain, and a passing glimpse of some mummy-necked farmer, and all around alternating strips of quicksilverish water and harsh green corn, the whole arrangement opening like a fan somewhere in Kansas. Now and then in the vastness of those plains, huge trees would advance towards us to cluster self-consciously by the roadside and provide a bit of humanitarian shade above a picnic table, with sunflecks, flattened paper cups, samaras and discarded ice cream sticks littering the brown ground. A great user of roadside facilities, my unfastidious Lo would be charmed by toilet signs. Guys, gals, John Jane, Jack Jill, and even Bucks Doze. While, lost in an artist's dream, I would stare at the honest brightness of the gasoline paraphernalia against the splendid green of oaks, or at a distant hill scrambling out, scarred but still untamed, from the wilderness of agriculture that was trying to swallow it. At night, tall trucks studded with coloured lights, like dreadful giant Christmas trees, loomed in the darkness and thundered by the belated little sedan. And again next day, a thinly populated sky, losing its blue to the heat, would melt overhead, and Lo would clamour for a drink, and her cheeks would hollow vigorously over the straw, and the car inside would be a furnace when we got in again, and the road shimmered ahead with a remote car changing its shape mirage-like in the surface glare, and seeming to hang for a moment, old-fashionedly square and high, in the hot haze. And as we pushed westward, patches of what the garage man called sagebrush appeared, and then the mysterious outlines of table-like hills, and then red bluffs ink-blotted with junipers, and then a mountain range dun grading into blue, and blue into dream, and the desert would meet us with a steady gale, dust-grey thorn bushes and hideous bits of tissue paper mimicking pale flowers among the prickles of wind-tortured withered stalks all along the highway, in the middle of which there sometimes stood simple cows, immobilized in a position, tail left, white eyelashes right, cutting across all human rules of traffic. My lawyer has suggested I give a clear, frank account of the itinerary we followed, and I suppose I have reached here a point where I cannot avoid that chore. Roughly during that mad year, August 1947 to August 1948, our route began with a series of wiggles and whirls in New England, then meandered south, up and down, east and west, dipped deep into ce qu'on appelle Dixieland, avoided Florida because the Farlows were there, veered west, zigzagged through corn belts and cotton belts. This is not too clear, I'm afraid, Clarence, but I did not keep any notes and have at my disposal only an atrociously crippled tour book in three volumes, almost a symbol of my torn and tattered past in which to check these recollections. Crossed and recrossed the Rockies, straggled through southern deserts where we wintered, reached the Pacific, turned north through the pale lilac fluff of flowering shrubs along forest roads, almost reached the Canadian border, and proceeded east across good lands and bad lands, back to agriculture on a grand scale, avoiding, despite Little Low's strident remonstrations, Little Low's birthplace, in a corn, coal and hog-producing area, and finally returned to the fold of the east, petering out in the college town of Beardsley. Now, in perusing what follows, the reader should bear in mind not only the general circuit, as adumbrated above, with its many side trips and tourist traps, secondary circles and skittish deviations, but also the fact that, far from being an indolent partie de plaisir, our tour was a hard, twisted, teleological growth, whose sole raison d'être, these French clichés are symptomatic, was to keep my companion in passable humour from kiss to kiss. Thumbing through that battered tour book, I dimly evoke that magnolia garden in a southern state which cost me $4 and which, according to the ad in the book, you must visit for three reasons. Because John Galsworthy, a stone-dead writer of sorts, acclaimed it as the world's fairest garden. Because in 1900 Baedeker's Guide had marked it with a star. And finally because, oh reader, my reader, guess, because children. And by jingo, was not my Lolita a child? Will walk starry-eyed and reverently through this foretaste of heaven, drinking in beauty that can influence a life. Not mine, said Grim Low, and settled down on a bench with the fillings of two Sunday papers in her lovely lap. We passed and repassed through the whole gamut of American roadside restaurants, from the lowly Eat, with its deer head, dark trace of long tear at inner canthus, humorous picture postcards of the posterior Kurort type, impaled guest checks, lifesavers, sunglasses, Adman visions of celestial Sundays, one half of a chocolate cake under glass, and several horribly experienced flies zigzagging over the sticky sugar paw on the ignoble counter. And all the way to the expensive place, with the subdued lights, preposterously poor table linen, inept waiters, ex-convicts or college boys, the roan back of a screen actress, the sable eyebrows of her male of the moment, and an orchestra of zoot suitors with trumpets. We inspected the world's largest stalagmite in a cave where three southeastern states have a family reunion. Admission by age, adults $1, pubescents 60 cents. A granite obelisk commemorating the Battle of Blue Licks, with old bones and Indian pottery in the museum nearby. Low a dime, very reasonable. The present log cabin boldly simulating the past log cabin where Lincoln was born. A boulder with a plaque in memory of the author of Trees. By now we're in Poplar Cove, North Carolina, reached by what my kind, tolerant, usually so restrained tour book angrily calls a very narrow road poorly maintained, to which, though no Kilmerite, I subscribe. From a hired motorboat operated by an elderly but still repulsively handsome white Russian, a baron, they said, Lowe's palms were damp, the little fool, who had known in California good old Maximovich and Valeria, we could distinguish the inaccessible millionaire's colony on an island, somewhere off the Georgia coast. We inspected further, a collection of European hotel picture postcards in a museum devoted to hobbies at a Mississippi resort, where with a hot wave of pride I discovered a coloured photo of my father's Mirana, its striped awnings, its flag flying above the retouched palm trees. So what, said Lowe, squinting at the bronze donor of an expensive car who had followed us into the hobby house. Relics of the cotton era, a forest in Arkansas, and on her brown shoulder a raised purple-pink swelling, the work of some gnat, which I eased of its beautiful transparent poison between my long thumbnails, and then sucked till I was gorged on her spicy blood. Bourbon Street, in a town named New Orleans, whose sidewalks, said the tour book, may, I like the may, feature entertainment by pickaninnies, who will, I like the will, even better, tap dance for pennies, what fun, while its numerous small and intimate nightclubs are thronged with visitors, naughty. Collections of frontier lore. Antebellum homes with iron trellis balconies and handwork stairs, the kind down which movie ladies with sun-kissed shoulders run in rich technicolour, holding up the fronts of their flounce skirts with both little hands in that special way, and the devoted negress shaking her head on the upper landing. The Menninger Foundation, a psychiatric clinic, just for the heck of it. A patch of beautifully eroded clay, and yucca blossoms, so pure, so waxy, but lousy with creeping white flies. Independence, Missouri, the starting point of the old Oregon Trail, and Abilene, Kansas, the home of the Wild Bill Something Rodeo. Distant mountains, near mountains, more mountains, bluish beauties, never attainable, or ever turning into inhabited hill after hill. Southeastern ranges, altitudinal failures as Alps go. Heart and sky-piercing, snow-veined grey colossi of stone. Relentless peaks appearing from nowhere at a turn of the highway, timbered enormities, with a system of neatly overlapping dark firs interrupted in places by pale puffs of aspen, pink and lilac formations, pharaonic phallic, too prehistoric for words, blasé low, butts of black lava, early spring mountains with young elephant lanugo along their spines, end of the summer mountains all hunched up, their heavy Egyptian limbs folded under folds of tawny moth-eaten plush, oatmeal hills flecked with green round oaks, a last rufous mountain with a rich rug of lucerne at its foot. Moreover, we inspected Little Iceberg Lake, somewhere in Colorado, and the snowbanks, and the cushionettes of tiny alpine flowers, and more snow, down which Low in red-peaked cap tried to slide and squealed, and was snowballed by some youngsters and retaliated in kind. Come on, D. Skeletons of burned aspens, patches of spired blue flowers, the various items of a scenic drive. Hundreds of scenic drives, thousands of bare creeks, soda springs, painted canyons. Texas, a drought-struck plain. Crystal Chamber, in the longest cave in the world. Children under 12 free, Low, a young captive. A collection of a local lady's homemade sculptures, closed on a miserable Monday morning. Dust, wind, witherland. Conception Park, in a town on the Mexican border which I dared not cross. There and elsewhere, hundreds of grey hummingbirds in the dusk, probing the throats of dim flowers. Shakespeare, a ghost town in New Mexico, where bad man Russian Bill was colourfully hanged 70 years ago. Fish hatcheries, cliff dwellings, the mummy of a child, Florentine B's Indian contemporary. Our 20th Hell's Canyon, our 50th gateway to something or other, Fide, that tour book, the cover of which had been lost by that time. A tick in my groin. Always the same three old men in hats and suspenders idling away the summer afternoon under the trees near the public fountain. A hazy blue view beyond railings on a mountain pass, and the backs of a family enjoying it, with Low in a hot, happy, wild, intense, hopeful, hopeless whisper. Look, the McChrystals! Please, let's talk to them! Please, let's talk to them, reader! Please, I'll do anything you want! Oh, please! Indian ceremonial dances, strictly commercial. Art, American Refrigerator Transit Company. Obvious Arizona. Pueblo dwellings, aboriginal pictographs. A dinosaur track in a desert canyon printed there 30 million years ago, when I was a child. A lanky 6-foot pale boy with an active Adam's apple ogling Low and her orange-brown bare midriff, which I kissed 5 minutes later, Jack. Winter in the desert, spring in the foothills, almonds in bloom. Reno, a dreary town in Nevada with a nightlife said to be cosmopolitan and mature. A winery in California, with a church built in the shape of a wine barrel. Death Valley, Scotty's Castle. Works of art collected by one Rogers over a period of years. The ugly villas of handsome actresses. R.L. Stevenson's footprint on an extinct volcano. Mission Dolores, good title for a book. Surf-carved sandstone festoons. A man having a lavish epileptic fit on the ground in Russian Gulch State Park. Blue, blue Crater Lake. A fish hatchery in Idaho and the state penitentiary. Somber Yellowstone Park and its coloured hot springs. Baby geysers, rainbows of bubbling mud, symbols of my passion. A herd of antelopes in a wildlife refuge. our 100th cavern. Adults $1, Lolita 50 cents. A chateau built by a French marquis in North Dakota. A corn palace in South Dakota. And the huge heads of presidents carved in towering granite. The bearded woman read our jingle and now she is no longer single. A zoo in Indiana where a large troop of monkeys lived on concrete replica of Christopher Columbus's flagship. Billions of dead or half-dead fish-smelling mayflies in every window of every eating place all along a dreary sandy shore. Fat gulls on big stones as seen from the ferry city of Cheboygan, whose brown woolly smoke arched and dipped over the green shadow it cast on the aquamarine lake. A motel whose ventilator pipe passed under the city sewer. Lincoln's home largely spurious with parlour books and period furniture that most visitors reverently accepted as personal belongings. We had rows, minor and major. The biggest ones we had took place at Lacework Cabins, Virginia, on Park Avenue, Little Rock, near a school, on Milner Pass, 10,759 feet high in Colorado, at the corner of 7th Street and Central Avenue in Phoenix, Arizona, on 3rd Street, Los Angeles, because the tickets to some studio or other were sold out, at a motel called Poplar Shade in Utah, where 6 pubescent trees were scarcely taller than my Lolita, and where she asked, apropos de rien, how long did I think we were going to live in stuffy cabins doing filthy things together and never behaving like ordinary people, on North Broadway, Burns, Oregon, corner of West Washington, facing Safeway, a grocery, in some little town in the Sun Valley of Idaho, before a brick hotel, pale and flushed bricks nicely mixed with opposite a poplar playing its liquid shadows all over the local honor roll, in a sagebrush wilderness between Pinedale and Farson, somewhere in Nebraska on Main Street near the First National Bank established 1889 with a view of a railway crossing in the vista of the street, and beyond that the white organ pipes of a multiple silo, and on McEwen Street, corner of Wheaton Street, in a Michigan town bearing his first name. We came to know the curious roadside species Hitchhiking Man, Homo Pollex of science, with all his many subspecies and forms. The modest soldier, spick and span, quietly waiting, quietly conscious of khaki's viatic appeal. The schoolboy wishing to go 2 blocks. The killer wishing to go 2,000 miles. The mysterious, nervous, elderly gent with brand new suitcase and clipped moustache. A trio of optimistic Mexicans. The college student, displaying the grime of vocational outdoor work as proudly as the name of the famous college arching across the front of his sweatshirt. The desperate lady whose battery has just died on her. The clean-cut, glossy-haired, shifty-eyed, white-faced young beasts in loud shirts and coats, vigorously, almost priapically, thrusting out tense thumbs to tempt lone women or sad-sack salesmen with fancy cravings. "Let's take him," Lo would often plead, rubbing her knees together in a way she had, as some particularly disgusting Pollex, some man of my age and shoulder-breadth, with the fas-a-clac of an unemployed actor, walking backwards practically in the path of our car. Oh, I had to keep a very sharp eye on Lo. Little limp Lo. Owing perhaps to constant amorous exercise, she radiated, despite her very childish appearance, some special languorous glow which threw garage fellows, hotel pages, vacationists, goons in luxurious cars, maroon morons near blued pools, into fits of concupiscence which might have tickled my pride had it not incensed my jealousy. For little Lo was aware of that glow of hers, and I would often catch her coulant un regard in the direction of some amiable male, some grease monkey, with a sinewy golden-brown forearm and a watch-braceleted wrist. And hardly had I turned my back to go and buy this very Lo a lollipop than I would hear her and the fair mechanic burst into a perfect love song of wisecracks. When, during our longer stops, I would relax after a particularly violent morning in bed, and out of the goodness of my lulled heart allow her, indulgent hum, to visit the rose garden or children's library across the street with a motor court neighbour's plain little Mary and Mary's 8-year-old brother, Lo would come back an hour late with barefoot Mary trailing far behind and the little boy metamorphosed into 2 gangling, golden-haired high school uglies, all muscles and gonorrhea. The reader may well imagine what I answered my pet when, rather uncertainly, I admit, she would ask me if she could go with Carl and Al here to the roller-skating rink. I remember the first time, a dusty, windy afternoon, I did let her go to one such rink. Cruelly, she said it would be no fun if I accompanied her, since that time of day was reserved for teenagers. We wrangled out a compromise. I remained in the car, among other empty cars, with their noses to the canvas-topped open-air rink, where some 50 young people, many in pairs, were endlessly rolling round and round to mechanical music, and the wind silvered the trees. Dolly wore blue jeans and white high shoes, as most of the other girls did. I kept counting the revolutions of the rolling crowd, and suddenly she was missing. When she rolled past again, she was together with three hoodlums, who I had heard analyse a moment before the girl skaters from the outside, and jeer at a lovely leggy young thing who had arrived clad in red shorts instead of those jeans or slacks. At inspection stations on highways entering Arizona or California, a policeman's cousin would peer with such intensity at us that my poor heart wobbled. "Any honey?" he would inquire, and every time my sweet fool giggled. I still have, vibrating all along my optic nerve, visions of Lo on horseback, a link in the chain of a guided trip along a bridal trail. Lo, bobbing at a walking pace, with an old woman rider in front and a lecherous redneck dude rancher behind, and I behind him, hating his fat, flowery-shirted back even more fervently than a motorist does a slow truck on a mountain road. Or else at a ski lodge I would see her floating away from me, celestial and solitary, in an ethereal chairlift, up and up to a glittering summit where laughing athletes stripped to the waist were waiting for her. For her! In whatever town we stopped, I would inquire, in my polite European way, anent the whereabouts of natatoriums, museums, local schools, the number of children in the nearest school, and so forth. And at school bus time, smiling and twitching a little, I discovered this tic nerveux because cruel Lo was the first to mimic it. I would park at a strategic point, with my vagrant schoolgirl beside me in the car, to watch the children leave school, always a pretty sight. This sort of thing soon began to bore my so easily bored Lolita. And having a childish lack of sympathy for other people's whims, she would insult me and my desire to have her caress me while blue-eyed little brunettes in blue shorts, copperheads in green boleros, and blurred boyish blondes in faded slacks passed by in the sun. As a sort of compromise, I freely advocated whenever and wherever possible the use of swimming pools with other girl children. She adored brilliant water and was a remarkably smart diver. Comfortably robed, I would settle down in the rich post-meridian shade after my own demure dip, and there I would sit, with a dummy book or a bag of bonbons or both, or nothing but my tingling glands, and watch her gambol rubber-capped, bepearled, smoothly tanned, as glad as an ad, in her trim-fitted satin pants and shirred bra. Pubescent sweetheart! How smugly I would marvel she was mine, mine, mine! And revise the recent matutinal swoon to the moan of the mourning doves, and devise the late afternoon one, and slitting my sun-speared eyes, compare Lolita with whatever other nymphette's parsimonious chants collected around her for my anthological delectation and judgment. And today, putting my hand on my ailing heart, I really do not think that any of them ever surpassed her in desirability, or if they did, it was so two or three times at the most, in a certain light, with certain perfumes blended in the air, once in the hopeless case of a pale Spanish child, the daughter of a heavy-jawed nobleman, and another time, mais je divague. Naturally, I had to be always wary, fully realizing in my lucid jealousy the danger of those dazzling romps. I had only to turn away for a moment, to walk, say, a few steps in order to see if our cabin was at last ready after the morning change of linen, and lo and behold, upon returning, I would find the former, les yeux perdus, dipping and kicking her long-toed feet in the water on the stone edge of which she lolled, while on the other side of her there crouched a brun adolescent, whom her russet beauty and the quicksilver in the baby folds of her stomach were sure to cause to se tordre. Oh, Baudelaire, in recurrent dreams for months to come. I tried to teach her to play tennis, so we might have more amusements in common, but although I'd been a good player in my prime, I proved to be hopeless as a teacher. And so, in California, I got her to take a number of very expensive lessons with a famous coach, a husky, wrinkled old-timer with a harem of ball-boys. He looked an awful wreck off the court, but now and then, when in the course of a lesson, to keep up the exchange, he would put out, as it were, an exquisite spring blossom of a stroke and twang the ball back to his pupil. That divine delicacy of absolute power made me recall that 30 years before I had seen him in Cannes demolish the great Gobert. Until she began taking those lessons, I thought she would never learn the game. On this or that hotel court I would drill low and try to relive the days when in a hot gale, a daze of dust and queer lassitude, I fed ball after ball to gay, innocent, elegant Annabel, gleam of bracelet, pleated white skirt, black velvet hairband. With every word of persistent advice, I would only augment Lowe's sullen fury. To our games, oddly enough, she preferred, at least before we reached California, formless pat-ball approximations, more ball-hunting than actual play, with a wispy, weak, wonderfully pretty in an ange-gauche way, coeval. A helpful spectator, I would go up to that other child and inhale her faint, musky fragrance as I touched her forearm and held her knobby wrist and pushed this way or that her cool thigh to show her the backhand stance. In the meantime, Lo, bending forward, would let her sunny brown curls hang forward as she stuck her racket like a crippled stick into the ground and emitted a tremendous ugh of disgust at my intrusion. I would leave them to their game and look on, comparing their bodies in motion, a silk scarf round my throat. This was in South Arizona, I think, and the days had a lazy lining of warmth, and awkward Lo would slash at the ball and miss it, and curse, and send a simulacrum of a serve into the net, and show the wet, glistening young down of her armpit as she brandished her racket in despair, and her even more insipid partner would dutifully rush out after every ball and retrieve none. But both were enjoying themselves beautifully, and in clear, ringing tones kept the exact score of their ineptitudes all the time. One day, I remember, I offered to bring them cold drinks from the hotel, and went up the gravel path and came back with 2 tall glasses of pineapple juice, soda and ice, and then a sudden void within my chest made me stop as I saw that the tennis court was deserted. I stooped to set down the glasses on a bench, and for some reason, with a kind of icy vividness, saw Charlotte's face in death. And I glanced around and noticed Lo in white shorts receding through the speckled shadow of a garden path in the company of a tall man who carried 2 tennis rackets. I sprang after them, but as I was crashing through the shrubbery, I saw in an alternate vision, as if life's course constantly branched, Lo in slacks and her companion in shorts, trudging up and down a small weedy area and beating bushes with their rackets in listless search for their last lost ball. I itemize these sunny nothings, mainly to prove to my judges that I did everything in my power to give my Lolita a really good time. How charming it was to see her, a child herself, showing another child some of her few accomplishments, such as, for example, a special way of jumping rope. With her right hand holding her left arm behind her untanned back, the lesser nymphette, a diaphanous darling, would be all eyes, as the Pavonine sun was all eyes on the gravel under the flowering trees, while in the midst of that oculate paradise my freckled and raffish lass skipped, repeating the movements of so many others I had gloated over on the sun-shot, watered, damp-smelling sidewalks and ramparts of ancient Europe. Presently she would hand the rope back to her little Spanish friend, and watch in her turn the repeated lesson, and brush away the hair from her brow, and fold her arms, and step on one toe with the other, or drop her hands loosely upon her still unflared hips. And I would satisfy myself that the damned staff had at last finished cleaning up our cottage, whereupon, flashing a smile to the shy, dark-haired page girl of my princess, and thrusting my fatherly fingers deep into Lo's hair from behind, and then gently but firmly clasping them around the nape of her neck, I would lead my reluctant pet to our small home for a quick connection before dinner. "Whose cat has scratched poor you?" a full-blown, fleshy, handsome woman of the repulsive type to which I was particularly attractive might ask me at the lodge during a table d'hôte dinner followed by dancing promised to Lo. This was one of the reasons why I tried to keep as far away from people as possible, while Lo, on the other hand, would do her utmost to draw as many potential witnesses into her orbit as she could. She would be, figuratively speaking, wagging her tiny tail, her whole behind, in fact, as little bitches do, while some grinning stranger accosted us and began a bright conversation with a comparative study of license plates. Long way from home! Inquisitive parents, in order to pump low about me, would suggest her going to a movie with their children. We had some close shaves. The waterfall nuisance pursued me, of course, in all our caravanseries. But I never realized how wafery their wall substance was until one evening, after I had loved too loudly, a neighbor's masculine cough filled the pores as clearly as mine would have done. The next morning, as I was having breakfast at the milk bar, Lo was a late sleeper, and I liked to bring her a pot.